You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to Counterculture here with Marie on Reality Check Radio. And it is like welcoming an old friend over for a cup of coffee. I've said it before, haven't caught up with her for 2024. Helen Houghton, leader of the New Conservatives, welcome back.
Oh, good morning, Marie. It's so good to be back here. You know, I mean, first off, can I thank you? Thank you and your team. It's wonderful to be back. We didn't even know we were going to be able to hear you anymore, and we can't take it for granted that you'll always be there. Actually saying that, it's up to us, all of us, to support you to remain in this space, providing this platform for the conversation that many New Zealanders not only want but have a right to. So I thank you, and it's good to be back.
Oh, thanks, Helen. Yeah, she was a bit touch and go there for a bit, but you know, we have a plan, and that's the nice thing. We've put the plan out for everybody to see. It's no great trade secret. It's no
conspiracy theory.
it is there. It is, the plan is there, and yeah. So touch wood, knock the head. It's so far so good. So you know, it is good to be back, and it's been good to be having these conversations. Now let's kick things off with a few announcements before we dive into. We've got lots of little topics we want to touch today because it's been so long since we've caught up. But you've got a couple of bits of news, and do tell.
Well, there's one thing that I feel like some of your audience may want to know about. It's very exciting for those who are out there, and they may, for those who don't know, there's a lawsuit over in Australia, which is a landmark case called, would you believe it, Tickle versus Giggle. That's a bit of a giggle in itself, but it's a lawsuit from, there's a male who likes to identify as a woman, and he has taken a lady called Sal Grover to court for discrimination. Now, Sal Grover started a female-only app, and they found out that this male had signed up, and so they removed him from the platform, and he then went ahead and took her to court. So this is in progress now, and I'm sure there's lots of your listeners who would be following this case, and to let them know, we have Sal coming over. So Sal Grover is coming over, a bit of a rhyme there. She's coming over to New Zealand in the first week of July, and there's a few of us who are setting up some panels up and down the country. So here in Christchurch, I'm setting up a panel. There will be Sal Grover, myself, women's rights leader Jill Ovens, and we also have a parent of a transgender child who will be, or someone who is claiming to be transgender, who will be on the panel. Now, I'm going to set that up. I will update you with the exact date and venue, because at this stage I'm trying to set up the venue on the university campus. Watch the space around that. But Jill Ovens is organising her panel up in Auckland, and I think they're trying to organise something in Wellington as well. So we will update you and put out some invites to that, but just have that in the back of your mind that, first week of July for anybody who wants to travel to this panel, it'd be well worth coming along to. There'll be time for questions and mingling afterwards, so it'd be great to meet up with Sal. I thought that might interest,
And we should try, I'll get you to try and hook Sal and I up, and we can have a chat sort of leading into the panels, and that will give people a really, really good foundation, because she's done a number of interviews now that it's the Tickle versus Giggle, that you've got to shine a spotlight on this absolute lunacy that's going on. So, that sounds absolutely fantastic. Unsilenced, of course, was, a few weekends ago in Wellington, and you mentioned before about people that you're pulling together with the panel. So some of the feedback that I've had in speaking with Di Landy the other day was, it was the detransitioner Mel that they had across from Melbourne. That was one of the most touching speeches of the entire event. To see headlines, I saw a recent one on the spin-off. This was the headline: fear, hate, and a putrid stench inside the unsilenced anti-trans event. That was the headline. A chap by the name of John McManus, he went in to the event.
Wow.
Yeah, and it just, to me, just the headline alone.
That's a mouthful, isn't it?
It is a mouthful. And it typifies, I think, this chasm between the entrenched belief that these trans radical activists have And anything that challenges their belief is, in this case, fear, hate, and a putrid stench. You know, you just sort of can't sort of battle that. And it was interesting, like you you sent me a few text messages recently because you watched The Web of Chaos. For the first time. It's so funny, I had another friend, Marty, I do Media Matters, he saw it for the first time. And it was the first slot since Sunday had come off air, and that's what they popped in. 2 years old. Now, I saw it first time around, and of course I howled laughing because I've been called every ad hominem under the sun in the last 6 years since I've been sort of in the trenches of this culture battle. And after The Web of Chaos, I got to actually add to the shelf Domestic Terrorist. And I think that personally is my favourite because I'm the most unlikely domestic terrorist known to man. But, you know, being a middle-aged woman who has Instagram accounts, who likes crafting, looking after her children, I am of a Celtic complexion and I like to cook for my family and I do arts and crafts. If my hair were long enough, I would have braided it. Helen, yours is certainly long enough for braiding. Who knew? Who knew we were so dangerous?
Well, funny enough, I do braid my hair occasionally, and I've been on Pinterest. I was on it for years as my, you know, teacher career. I love knitting. I teach women how to knit, sewing, crochet. You have to laugh. I mean, it was kind of a comedy hour, apart from the concern that this actual misinformation actually has some people thinking it's factual. So that's a concern. You know, I mean, we have young women who actually are having to defend themselves about wanting to be a particular type of wife and mother, i.e. loving, giving, and nurturing, opposed to putting children into daycare 5 days a week from dawn till dusk and buying chemical engineering fast food over homegrown, home-cooked, nutritious meals. Heaven forbid you dress pretty, enjoy cleaning the house and be a stay-at-home mum. I mean, golly, you know, there's a real deconstruction of family in that sense, isn't there? Why I can't understand why Kate Hanna has such an anti-white Christian stance. It's actually a tad racist. She did say, she used the term white Christian. Mm. I mean, in my opinion, I don't know about you, but that's a tad racist remark, and it's discriminative. It's really crazy. I think after watching that, I kind of felt like some people there might need some counselling because...
Well, I think it's because the whole intersectional critical theory movement is the new religion. And they've become absolutely messianic in their belief. They're totally fundamental about it. I mean, you just have to look at the actions. I mean, it borders on extreme and cult-like. So when you see that and you look at any other extremist groups, say, that do hold faith of some sort, you can kind of see why they do lash out at faiths, especially Christian faiths. And I mean, now most people in that ilk too have become exceptionally anti-Semitic. But if you actually place that back at them saying, well, you realise that you are being very anti-Semitic and what that actually means, well, the cognitive dissonance with that they have to face, well, they'll throw that out. You know, they can't deal with that whatsoever. And I think, you are dead right. I think that there is a deconstruction of the family, of Western values, of faith for those that hold faith, that they want to tear down. After 2 years of its first airing, I think Web of Chaos, I think a lot of people who aren't deeply tapped into this culture war as we are would have looked at that and thought, what a crock of crap. What is that woman going on about? The hand washing. You know, it was just, I mean, it actually was, it's quite farcical on a second watch.
Yeah, it is. It's like, take a step back if you see these women who are, and we're recruiting. I mean, you know, we're just actually enjoying knitting, for goodness sake. But look, there's also, I mean, I don't know much about this David Farrier, but, you know, his comments about angels and demons, like Christians, as if Christians seeing good and evil as woo-woo, yet TVNZ can host program series where people claim they talk to the dead and that they think Christians are woo-woo. It's so nonsensical the way that they are, you know, talking about these things with the trad wives and, you know, they're finding issues in women who are traditional. I mean, I have to admit to your listeners, I didn't know what a trad wife was. I thought, well, what is this? I had to Google it, and all it is a tradition woman who likes traditional marriage and taking care of your family and baking and enjoys cleaning the house. I mean, I do enjoy cleaning my house. I don't often have time to do it, so that gets frustrating, but I enjoy things like that. It's satisfying. And yet things like chopping off your boobs and penis to indulge an uncomfortable feeling is glorified on TV, and yet they are, you know, treating people who like to clean the house and look after their husbands and all of that as if you're a terrorist organization. She said drawing other women in. Oh my gosh.
The interesting thing is that, of course, again, being a couple of years old, she was saying, you know, drawing other women in. Well, most of them now want to erase women, don't they?
Oh, yes.
You know, they want to erase. Yes, I've been reading Trans by Helen Joyce, and I've had the book since I spoke to her last year, and I've thought, right, I'm actually doing a combo. I've just finished Abigail Schreier, and I'm now on to Trans with Helen Joyce. And one of the interesting chapters that I've just completed, and she was talking about in terms of the language, you know how there's been the manipulation in language, so all the feminization of language has disappeared. So there's no more, I mean, women don't get pregnant, it's you know, people with uteruses and people who menstruate and chest feeders and all these stuff. So anything that is feminized is gone. But if you look at the numbers of people that are transitioning, it is... And traditionally, in the old transsexual days, it was mostly men to women transitions. Now it's the other way around. It's reversed to young women transitioning to become men. But there's been no demasculinization of language.
Such a good point to make, Marie.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. It hadn't occurred to me, and she was right. And she gave a number of examples. There's been no demasculinization. So therefore, they talk about transgenocide. I mean, is this a gay genocide? Is this a female genocide? Are they trying to get, if you're going to throw those sorts of hyperbolic statements about, what you're really trying to convert and get rid of really are gays and women.
Yeah, you would think that the third wave, was it fourth wave, I can't keep up, feminists are would be all over that. Really, wouldn't you? Like you said, you know, there's no attack on the male language. And, yeah, why are they not rising up? It does make you wonder, or maybe they are and they're just being silenced like others. But, you know, if you look back at that, we can delve into that and want to lead us down so many different other rabbit holes. Yeah, but look, I'm sure that your listeners probably most of them didn't know what a trad wife is either. I did a little video and many people, actually it's had 2,000 views and many people obviously find it fascinating what is a trad wife. So, yeah, did a little bit of a thing into that. I just think that, you know, we need to have these conversations because even though we found it funny, you know, it is alarming that this is what our young people are growing up led to believe. It's no different than, you know, you see that title was, what is it? The first thing was fear and hate. And it's like that book that's Byron Clark wrote, Fear. You know, they're portraying people as something to be feared. And while we all know that it's nonsense, there's a lot of people out there that, you know, will see that and think, you know, that maybe there's some facts to this, especially when it's coming from people who are in university as well. And I know you wanted to touch a little bit on university at some point. My concern is, you know, we need to be in this watchdog space because I felt like my job had almost been done. You know, when I thank Juby for, there's also a lot of other people I want to thank. So I'm feeling a bit generous today. But it's only because, I mean, you know, I've said it often enough, I only got involved in this whole, in the political realm because of the gender in the schools. I thought now that, you know, some others have picked it up, I can kind of maybe, you know, not sit back, but maybe I'm not needed in this space anymore. But there's so many other areas like this and, you know, with speech and things that are happening on university and that make me really concerned for the next generation. You know, we can never allow, and it's strong words, allow the Green and Labor to have the majority in power again, because this is what what has happened with media and everything, how, you know, they're molding our next generation to believe in all this nonsense. So as I said, I'm fairly generous. I want to thank Bob McCroskey and Family First. I didn't even know him previous to, you know, me finding this gender stuff in schools. And I gained so much insight from these good people who want to protect our families and society, resist gender education, let kids be kids, the Landy sisters, Jill Ovens, Katrina Briggs, Hannah Tamaki, and there's so many more people that I could list on here, even including commentators such as your team, some of those on the platform. You know, they've all picked it up now and you hear the conversations everywhere, and I'm so grateful to see that. And that means I can free myself up to not step back from politics, but actually push more in other areas that I see we do have a lot of issues, because this is so much deeper than just removing the gender ideology from schools. The more I see, the more I am concerned about these issues. Did you see the recent article with the young girl who tried to cut off her breasts from home?
The box cutter, yeah.
You've got these teens who are being influenced, and we know that the online space is not going to go away, and so we need to actually jump into that and start talking about the protections that are needed. I have a girlfriend. She is about to go through a process of a double mastectomy due to cancer. You know, she told me some of the things that will happen afterwards and what she can't do and how she won't be able to lift anything above her, you know, she won't be able to do anything, she won't be able to drive. And yet you've got this article. Did you read that article about the trans?
It was almost glorification, and their solution was, and their anger was that there wasn't enough time, funding and surgeons to be able to affirm this young woman's desire to have her double mastectomy. This is one of the things with the affirmation model, Helen. I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but I find utterly incredible, because it's the only healthcare model. I spoke to Dr. Carrie Mendoza about this several weeks ago, where you have complete affirmation. So whatever it is that they desire, you affirm and say, we will try and make this happen for you. Now, if that girl was an anorexic, and she was ended up in hospital because she was an anorexic and a bulimic, and she'd vomited too much and she'd had a gastrointestinal issue. I mean, you don't sit down and plead and write a story saying, well, Fatty over there, you know, didn't do a good enough job, and we're going to sit on the corner and starve her so she can get what she wants. It's insanity, absolute insanity. Yeah.
It is insanity, and this is such a they're such private, sensitive issues anyway. And yet, yeah, like you said, it's out there for all to see and for all lift her up and glorify her and hold her on a pedestal. But look, in the article, it says surgery went well and the teen was discharged a day later. Now, I just finished telling you, my friend, you know, all the things that are going to happen for her after her double mastectomy. It's not just, oh, yay, let's go and have surgery, chop off our breasts, and you're discharged a day later and off you go on your merry way. I mean, my gosh, it's just, you know, this article is so false, and how they are not pointing out the horrors, actually, that are going to go along with this, and the challenges that this young girl, even though the article right through it talks about him and he and, you know, we're talking about a child. We're talking about a child. It says he reported improvement in self-esteem and self-confidence and his ability to get this complete schoolwork. We're talking about a child who's still at school and is looking forward to enrolling at university. Now, this article talked about the fact that the 18-year-old female to male transgender man went to hospital several hours in the self-attempt mastectomy after he became concerned about damaging a nerve. But it talks about the fact that he had been on a waiting list and he was taking testosterone. And, you know, I'd like to do a bit of research on that, but I was under the impression that under 18-year-olds weren't allowed testosterone, because we used to talk about the puberty blockers, how there's, you know, high number of young people are now being prescribed puberty blockers, and then the testosterone, and people would be arguing, saying, no, you're exaggerating. No one's allowed testosterone before they're 18. And yet it's got in this article, the teen who had a background of gender dysphoria was on testosterone treatment and awaiting gender-affirming surgery. So what is it? So I'd like to know, you know, how many young people out there are already on testosterone? That's, yeah, that's appalling to think
it's that whole, this is where the whole social contagion thing comes in, doesn't it, with these kids? Because, I mean, I look at, I mean, that girl, when I was that age, if she was, you know, wanting to be male, I mean, that she would have been a Butch Dyke. And fully accepted and embraced by the lesbian community, if that's how she chose to identify. And there would have been no desire of the fact that she was anything other but a woman who happened to have outwardly very, you know, preferring masculine characteristics. And that was just fine. Fully accepted and embraced and loved and all the rest of it. Whereas now, if you show any signs of wanting to explore anything from the opposite gender, oh, you now must be trans, and it's cool and celebrated and affirmed to be trans. And I mean, you and I are a similar age. David, you know, you watch David Bowie and all of those things, and sometimes played around with your expression. And I just wonder how many of these kids, and when I say kids, I'm talking through to mid-20s here, are not being allowed to fully discover their own personal self-expression without being hijacked by this medical mafia.
Yeah, and I like the way that you used, you brought that up, the medical mafia. So it's actually the medical people in this article, the three doctors who are pushing it, because they're making it very clear that because this girl was distressed on this apparently long waiting list, yet she was only 18, on this waiting list to have the surgery, and now they're pushing out, you know, that they recognise there's a wait time for gender affirming care is lengthy and they're committed to addressing it. So you can see what their agenda is. Let's push this along further and have even more availability for these young people to quickly get in there and have this, you know, life-changing castration. And it's actually appalling. They've got this in a report in the New Zealand Medical Journal. So we can see what the agenda is here. That's really concerning. Now, this article also, she talked about the fact that she watched YouTube on how to do it, how to actually do it. And I bring this to you, I bring this up because just last night somebody shared something really disturbing. And this is something we might have to talk about another time, but they shared with me, and you might have heard about this. I'd never heard about it before, but this particular man who was, he went to prison for it, but he was guiding people to castrate themselves. Did you hear about this guy who, he was, you know, on the internet, one of these influencers, a bit like how this girl's gone to YouTube on a, you know, do it, self do it, to castrate yourself. He actually had a whole pile of people that, I'm just trying to find it, that he was castrating. He's a eunuch maker, so he's a UK man castrated. I've just put up castrated and sexually tortured dozens of men for paying viewers. And so this is what's happening with the online space. I mean, we've got to address this. You know, here we have people talking about, concerned about monitoring people's speech, but there's such a bigger concern out there for our young people and vulnerable.
You're right. Social media influencers have a tremendous sway, and that has been brought up. Abigail Schreier dedicates chapters to it. Alan Joyce talks about it endlessly. Even my sons, you know, they've got some friends in their friend group, and this is girls too I'm talking about. The girls are especially susceptible to this. And young boys too that I think will eventually identify as gay. And there's a couple of boys, one boy and a few girls in our son's extended friend group. And one of them sort of, you know, she was really suffering from some mental distress. And I said to my youngest son, who's quite, he's very socially aware, and I said, oh, you know, what's going on with her? And he said, oh, she spends at least 12 hours a day on TikTok. And that floored me, absolutely floored me. So I said to my son, well, do you even bother? And he said, no. He said, I don't bother with TikTok now. He said, it's like a black hole. He said, it just sucks you in.
Yeah, instead of teaching sex ed, maybe this is what we need to be teaching about the dangers of this. You know, it's there's a lot of easily accessible hypersexual objectification all over TikTok, Instagram, the whole lot of it. I mean, it's filled with all these, there's an illusion created, isn't there, with, you know, the selfie fillers, for example. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they used to talk about magazines, how that, well, that was not the real thing. But you look at, I mean, everyone's doing it. You know, you see mm-hmm. people that you know with all the fillers and you think, why are you using that? Because you're actually creating something that you're not. And I don't mean to be rude to anybody that does that. We all like to look nice. But what are we teaching our young ones where it's like you have to look perfect? And you can see how this is an issue with a lot of these young people who are looking at their bodies pre-pubertal and then they're seeing these filtered bodies or filtered characters of people that is not real. And so they're looking at it themselves, not happy with what they're seeing. And it's no surprise that some of them are going down this path of, well, maybe because I'm not growing right in this particular area, I need to be the other sex and, you know, go and have this bit added and I'll look much better. And, you know, I'm really concerned. This is a conversation we need to have. And like I said, I don't feel like I need to cover the education gender as much because there's so many people mm-hmm. in the watchdog space. Thank you to them all. I can maybe branch out and have a look at some of these other concerns. And, you know, I've always thought that we don't have enough protections in place in law for children and young people. The only thing that I've seen through my research is the orangatamariki kind of type protections around children. And I think, well, why not? Why are we not protecting the most precious individuals in our society, our children? So there's, yeah, we'll have to have a look at doing some things in that space. Well, sex is glorified, isn't it? Sex is glorified and it's prolific in societies. It actually causes anxiety to our adolescents who are pressured into that overindulgence of sexual content. And that starts at school with the sexuality education.
Well, and there's also too the education takes away, and it's really graphic. Like I was stunned at how graphic it was. I mean, there was no condoms on the bananas like there were in my day. And the biggest thing in that sort of education, you know, and I went through high school in the 80s, it was how to protect young women from unwanted pregnancies and STDs, and that was pretty much the sum total. Whereas some of the stuff that comes out now, and in my sons, because my sons are in Catholic school, theirs is nowhere near as permissive as what, you know, the guidelines taken by other more progressive state schools. I'm like, do the kids really need to know this? Because, I mean, ultimately, they're going to know all this stuff from being online anyway. So why are they putting it into school? Are they putting it into school to say to them that this is all very, very normal and okay? I mean, is it normal to have 27 genders? No.
Is it normal to, you know, be telling girls and boys that anal sex is part of sexuality where we know, you know, there's nothing talked about with what happens after with anal prolapse. And these things are talked about, like you said, like as if they're normal. I mean, since when would anybody talk about anal sex, for example, in school? But they're doing it. It's part of the lessons. I've seen it. I've shown it to parents. Parents are horrified. And I say to them, well, if you're horrified with me using that term, your 13-year-old girls and boys are hearing it. And not just hearing it, they're having to sit through lessons where it's part of the sex education. And, you know, you can kind of think, well, how do some of those girls feel? Do they feel like, oh, my gosh, this is something I'm going to have to do? This is something, I know this is real and raw, but we have to talk about this. This is something I'm going to have to do? You know, I mean, girls. And then you've got the boys thinking, really? Is this part of...
And then that's where pornography comes in. I interviewed Heidi Olsen, who was a sexual abuse nurse examiner. And that interview is probably one of the rawest that I've ever done. And she just blew my mind in terms of what she was saying. And she said there was 2015. She was put a stake in the ground. It was 2015 where they saw a dramatic uptick in sexual abuse cases. And she said in the change up until 2015, she said it was adult on child perpetrated to victim. From 2015, it then became child on child perpetrated to victim. And the leading cause of that was the fact that pretty much every kid had a device, a smartphone device, and they were connected, and it coincided with the prevalence of Pornhub. And so the expectations of healthy sexual intercourse and relationships wasn't based on a traditional model, a traditional healthy model. It was based on everything no holds barred, kink, the whole works burger of what was available on Pornhub. So that became the new normal. And that's really concerning. I mean, I have no issue with sexual education, but wouldn't it be good to actually teach kids about the barriers of, you know, these are the confines of a relationship, however you perceive the relationship to be, male and female, 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 male, male, it doesn't really matter. And the importance of, you know, that bonding and coming together and the emotional side of things, all of those sorts of elements. But no, you know, I mean, one of the things I saw, well, they were discussing this things like, as you said, all the elements of anal sex, which stuff that I never really even heard of until I was an adult. So, and these kids are 15 and 16 year olds being taught this. It's just absolute insanity.
Yeah, look, the connections, okay, between people and relationships, I mean, that's another big topic, but sex, you can say that sex is actually quite injurious, because when we, I mean, we know as adults who have been around, you know, and you see people, you know people, we know that there's broken marriages, there's broken relationships everywhere, and we see what happens with those broken relationships, are broken people, right? And you know, I'm divorced, and I know what happens when, you know, when you don't go into marriage thinking you're going to be divorced. You don't go into it. So you're in love, you love that person, you've made a connection, that's what a relationship does. So why I say it's injurious is you get hurt. People get hurt. It's not just about, oh, let's all go and have sex with everybody and you're not going to get hurt. Well, you are. So girls, and we know this, and I'm not saying boys don't have that connection, because they do as well, but I know that young girls, you know, they connect first before a sexual thing, mostly, right? And so they think that by, you know, the boy loves them because he wants, you know, he wants your attention, and you know, whereas we know that young boys, you know, are more sexually active on the whole, and so for them it's, you know, it can be that act, whereas a girl gets that bigger connection. Mm. And so you're having a lot of these connections broken at such a young age, and they hurt, and these, it's injurious, because you are, it's not just the physical act of it that can be injurious, but it's also the mental, the emotional. And so we have a lot of these really hurt young people who are just broken from, you know, starting out with sex too young, and many, a lot of it. And so, yeah, there's, you know, the connections, it's like we're not teaching that actually you don't have to be, you can be a whole person without having sex, right? I mean, yeah, it's like there's none of that conversation happening. It's like you can actually, you know, it's all sexual. It's like you can actually be a whole person without that. You can have enjoyable relationships without sex being involved. It's like they've just sexualized every single part of life. And to think that at school with children that it's illegal to have sex with, I don't know, 16 or something like that, and yet we're talking about this with 13, 14, 15-year-olds, you know, the sexual stuff is so huge that, yeah, the conversation, I'm glad to see that this coalition is dealing with some of the sex ed, but I'd love to be in that conversation. And I think more people, more parents, more community leaders need to be in that conversation around what is it that we need to teach children around sexuality, and when and how much and what is appropriate, because no one's addressing the fact that we've got so many hurt people in the community. And I'm sure that these young boys, so young men and young women, didn't want to, you know, be involved in that, where they're either hurting somebody else or they are the, you know, they are the ones that are being hurt. So what are we teaching children? How are we equipping them to have really good relationships that are meaningful, where they have self-respect for not just themselves but each other? Because there's too much of, you know, you see the court cases, men are being charged with, you know, the rape and the sexual attacks, assaults that are happening, have we equipped our young people to not actually be going down that path? You know, when the porn's there, like you said, when we're talking about all this hypersexual stuff, what have we equipped young people to not enter into sexual assault? I don't know. I think we're partly to blame. I think the communities need to take a deep look at themselves about what we are complicit in part of this. Yeah.
Well, again, a lot of it too is the relinquishing of the parenting of children to the schools. Because, you know, and a lot of that, and actually in a way this cycles back to our tradwife conversation earlier. Now, I mean, I've worked full time in one form or another the whole time that I've had my kids, and because we had to, but we built in flexibility and boundaries there because, you know, I've got a neurodiverse kid, so we had to do that. However, so often now, and you see it, you see these parents that from daycare, you just drop them off. Mm. And then that's it. It's done. You know, the parenting, all the influence, it's no longer just dropping it off and making sure your little one is at home and in a cared for environment, and then you pick them up fine. There's all these different elements of education that are of under development that's been brought all the way through from preschool all the way through to high school. And in a way, you know, unless you're really actively involved in what's going on with that, or knowing what's going on with that, the assumption of that I think most parents have, that our children are being taught what we were taught at school, is greatly misguided. And you need to be aware, because it's not what we were taught at school. Not by a country mile.
No, it's not. No, it's not. And you know, you said from pre right through to the end of high school. Well, the problem is too, and then some of them are going off to uni, and we know that. My gosh, the indoctrination doesn't stop.
So you're back at university. Come on, how's that going? Being an adult student back in the university environment. Come on, what are some of your observations? It must be fascinating.
Well, it has been. In the beginning, I was thinking, this looks like such a lefty, you know, diet full of diversity, you know, that language of, you know, all the diversity stuff going on. It's like that's almost like what I thought university was. It was so, can I say, almost rainbowy. However, when I look at all the lectures, the professors that I've had over the last 3 years, the encouraging thing that I can say is there are some traditional, very good, strong professors, lecturers there, but there's also some who are concerning. I don't know if I mentioned to you, I think it was my first or second year, where when it came to the exam time, you know, you have these 3-hour exams where you read a scenario and I'm in law, so I'm halfway through a law degree, and you read this scenario and then you have to go and, you know, work out this problem. And through this one particular lecture, she had, you know, in her exam, instead of it being, can I say, proper law exam, it was riddled with language that had been changed to suit the gender narrative. So it was full of things like, instead of saying he or she, it was them and they. And it just threw the whole, you know, you're already in an environment where it's stressful. It's really stressful doing exams, right? I mean, it's horrific. And so you're already heightened and you have to focus. And here you are reading this right through this scenario, trying to decipher this exam, which, you know, could mean passing or failing. And you have to actually read, navigate, and work out, well, what do you mean they, them? It's just nonsense. Yeah, and you look around thinking, does anybody else actually see this? So that's one example. But I did a little video probably a month or so ago on the couch with a counsellor where we unpacked one of these lecturers who has an article in the Canterbury University magazine. She's all about this whole she was saying basically how Canterbury University is not very inclusive. And I talked about this lecturer, I think she's Mudgeway. She might be the same French lady who opposed the recent free speech union discussion there. She talked about, it's no secret that Christchurch has a reputation for a lack of diversity For queer students moving to UC, it is understandably daunting moving to a new city that may not be as accepting of them as their previous homes. This is from a lecturer, right, at the university. Senior law lecturer, Cassandra Mudgeway, in one of UC's newest clubs, Queer in Law, are successfully creating transformative spaces for queer students to finally feel visible. So you've got this, you've got young people going into these lecture theatres, listening to a particular lecturer like this senior law person, who is framing the conversation in a way where...
I just want to pick out a quote from that, finally feel visible. What does she mean by finally feel visible? Knowing people that worked at, and I've got very good friends that were right at the forefront of homosexual law reform, and the whole point of homosexual law reform was to be just accepted by as any other member of the community. Why all of a sudden does the queer community believe that they need to be visible, because they have all the same equality and rights as any other individual? So what is this visibility that they require? Surely as long as they're comfortable in their own status of who they are, their own individuality. So does this visibility mean that everyone else has to accept their life choices? I mean, no, the world doesn't work like that, darling.
It doesn't, Marie. And how visible, can I ask you, how visible do you feel? Like, I mean, you know, I don't feel visible. I'm cancelled. But look, this is what she said. When I introduce myself to students, I say I'm part of the rainbow community and I'm neurodiverse, so they understand where I'm coming from. Now, I haven't had the pleasure of sitting in one of these lecturers, but my colleagues, or, you know, student colleagues have, and they've told me. They're thinking, well, why did she feel the need to tell them about being rainbow? We don't have other professors telling us that they're married, or that, you know, they've got six dogs and a cat, or, you know, we're not there. We don't care. I'm sorry, but that sounds harsh. But I don't care. We're paying good money. We pay money. We, you know, all these young people have massive debts. They're there to learn, you know, what they're interested in, or what it is that they're going to help the communities with, and the amazing law, you know, firms that they're going to work in. We're not there to care about or know about a professor or a lecturer's marriage, sexual orientation, who he sleeps with, who she sleeps with. And yet, yeah, I just find it like,
but see, that's part of the religious zealotry of it, you see, like we talked about earlier, is that when you are absorbed into this whole totem of hierarchy of oppressor and oppressed, and you are and there's these totems of victimhood, so by her announcing where she's at, so you're higher up the totem pole, if you have certain characteristics. Really what she's doing is signalling to anyone else in the room who's in the cult, this is where I sit on the totem. Whereas to the rest, it's just like, oh, darling, really, give it a rest. The rest, as you said, the rest of us don't care. We just want to learn about whatever.
Yeah. And we're not there looking at minority groups as anything. I mean, you know, this article is massive. It's a two-page spread, and there's so much in it. You know, you're talking about the victimhood. She said, for a long time, the law profession has been dominated by men, and it's structural, making it harder for outsiders to get in. This can be scary for students coming in who witness that culture. You've got her saying things down here, or there's one of the students have said, I personally faced a lot of violence when people perceive my sexuality, and I think that's still going on in Christchurch. I love Christchurch, but we can't forget its history, and that unfortunately does cast a shadow on the university. There's still a lot of hostility towards minority groups. I mean, really, where is the starter? Where's the starter that this is happening? You said it. We're just getting on with our business. We're all trying to survive. We're all trying to be kind, and we're trying to live our lives. We're trying to raise our children and our, you know, grandchildren, and be part of communities. We're not there attacking others. We're not there attacking people. It's you know, but this is okay. So just getting back to the thing, this is a lecturer, a senior lecturer in a university, and they are molding our young people going in. I talked in the, I think my first year with there's a lot of tikanga Māori aspects now to law, as you've probably heard about on the news. And so we sit through also a lot of those lectures. And, you know, from first year, I would have thought, well, that's it. Now we've done lots of that. But no, we're still doing it in third year. However, you know, so they're putting it in and you're getting this repetitive kind of narrative coming through. But in the first year of, you know, this whole cohort of mostly young people, we're sitting in a lecture theatre where there's like about 400 of us at the beginning. You start off, you know, with your first year cohort. And the law lecturer who was the Māori, doing the Māori aspect, you know, stood at the front and said how we're all going to feel uncomfortable, you know, and what she was going to teach us. And so she's putting it on to the students that, you know, they should feel shame. They should feel shame for what great-grandparents have, you know. It's like, how many generations of children are we going to keep blaming, putting the blame of onto? So yeah, there is a lot. You know, like I said,
for any of your other cohort, any of the other students, what are their thoughts on this?
Oh gosh, yeah, lots of them cringe when it comes to this type of, you know, these lecturers. But it's similar to the staff and that being silenced. You know, when I was teaching. Sound like, well, when I was back in that day, so when I was teaching, part of the culture, when you're in a staff meeting or, you know, having professional development, you just sit there and take it all in. You're not an active participant. You're just there to regurgitate you're just there to soak it all up. And so with staff meetings, it was often the case where, and don't get me wrong, most of my school management leaders have been amazing, but there's occasionally where the school culture is such that the principal is talking and you don't question it, you don't have an opinion. And, you know, I've been in one environment in particular where 30-ish teachers are sitting around and some of them are cringing, some of them disagree, but they will not voice it. They will not voice it. And the ironic thing is we were teaching children how to be critical thinkers and to to voice their opinions and to be strong in their voice. And yet here we are as educators, adult educators, who cannot do that, don't feel comfortable in doing it, because then you become like a scapegoat, you can be bullied. So there's a really bad culture in many aspects. I mean, you look at it where they're pushing this whole, you know, the Inside Out group, sorry, going off on a tangent, are pushing different organisations to do re-education. And you hear about different companies where they're saying, oh, I have to go and do this diversity course, but they can't actually say no. You know, it's like, we're adults and yet we're not able to say, actually, no, I don't agree. Because as soon as you do, then your job's on the line. Mm. And so I feel like that's what's happening, some of what's happening in some of these academic spaces as well. It's very clear with, what's her name, down south, it's Charlotte Poole. Charlotte Poole's the one speaking up about the puberty blockers, you know, the danger of that. And she has come out and said that because she's at the end of her career and towards retirement, she can speak now, whereas all those young people that are in that space, she knows that none of them. And they've said to her, these are academics that cannot speak up because their jobs are on the line. Okay, so there's that culture. Yeah, we need to change that culture.
So when you were at university doing tertiary education first time around to do your teaching, so doing law this time around, do you feel that the environment of self-censorship within the academy is the same, greater or to a lesser extent from first time to this time?
Oh, so much greater. And that's everywhere across society. But, yeah, definitely, definitely greater. I was 30 in my early 30s when I went the first time around. And, yeah, there would have been so much freedom, academic freedom, whereas now people are afraid to speak. You know, you the self-censoring is shocking. And, yeah, I think we need some brave people in there. You know, I get so excited when I know that I'm sitting across a professional person who is being professional and not falling into this trap. Or, you know, we've had a few where they say, for example, oh, I apologize for all this gendered language. There's a handful of lecturers I've had who will quite often say, again, I'm apologising for the gendered language. And I'm thinking, really? You know, it's not like we know we need to be mollycoddled about, oh, gosh, they're using the term he here a lot. Or, I mean, come on. Mm. Yeah, yeah, they are feeling that they have to apologise. And, you know, what are we apologising for? I don't understand it. What are we teaching people? What have we created? A society of self-indulgent victimhood where people feel the need that they need. I'm concerned that we're teaching young people that they need to get their affirmation from everybody else instead of looking inward and actually being strong within themselves. Don't you feel that?
Oh, it's like resilience. Yeah.
Resilience.
You know, I had a situation actually a few weekends ago. My son was involved in a school event, a big Catholic school event. And he, oh my gosh, the amount of work he put into this thing. And he was part of a team and he just hours and hours and hours of extracurricular. And we went to the event. And anyway, there was a setback that happened immediately before. Ultimately, that setback really did set them back fully in it, and they lost the debate. And he was devastated. I was devastated as a parent, you know, because you know how much work they put in and all the rest of it. But I remember saying to him, I said, "You're all right, mate." And he goes, "You know, yep, it's going to be different next year." And I thought, oh, good. Because it's that resiliency, because you can't always win. You can't, you know, things don't always go right. And to be able to hold it for as a parent, all I wanted to do was just, you know, kiss the boo-boo and make it better. And I had to stop myself because I'm like, because I've become part of the problem then. He needs to figure it out for himself and take the knock back and pick himself up and move forward. And I think as parents and mums especially, we have kind of made a rod for our own back sometimes, and we don't allow the kids to fall over, and we've wrapped them up in this veil of safety. And I think there's a real fine line between safety and risk. And Celia Lashley, especially with boys, and I know you've got boys, there's a really fine line between safety and risk. And risk is like a muscle, she used to say, and they have to exercise it. And they have to exercise it. So when they're in a decision-making situation, especially when they're behind, say, the wheel of a car or heading into a sexual encounter or whatever it is, that risk muscle is good and strong and they make correct decisions.
Yeah, look, I'm a guilty mum. I'm guilty of being of mummying, as in, you know, with two boys, and when they got older, I still did far too much mummying, I'm afraid. You know, one of my boys in particular will remind me of that, and I don't blame him, you know, but sometimes we just don't know. And you know, like you said, we find it hard to not wrap them up in cotton wool. But look, the schools are doing it. And so it's not, we didn't send them to school for that as their responsibility. We send them there to learn, to be taught academic stuff. And when I was teaching, we taught about change. Change was like a topic, you know, to help children realise that things happen. There's change all the time. And I don't know if they're teaching that anymore. It's more like, oh, yes, you know, child-centred. It's, you know, it's about their feelings. And, you know, I was just thinking something else you said, and I thought, well, young people don't have impulse control, and so they're being overwhelmed by adults thinking that they should have control. You know, it's like
puberty's difficult enough as it is. You know, I feel so sorry, especially for girls. I mean, puberty sucks for a girl.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the amount of pressure that these young women are under now for conformity to a social paradigm that is just so upside down clown world. I really, this is where I'm thankful that I've got teenage boys and not teenage girls. Mm. And, you know, it really is, you know, quite scary. Now, I'm just looking at the time. You and I could keep talking for hours. Mm. Again, you're bringing out the Sal Grover first week in July. We're definitely going to stay in touch over that and get more information out for people who would be interested in coming to hear Sal as you get those panels together. Also, too, anyone, you've been doing loads of really funny, as you said, funny and interesting videos, mostly on Facebook under Helen Houghton Conservative Party and your own personal page. Anywhere else that people need to look?
Conservative page, no, I can't, you know, I mean, I get cancelled and silenced everywhere as well. So, you know, I try and put something on somewhere and, you know, somebody doesn't like it and they'll complain and have it taken down. But no, it is at this point, basically on the Facebook, Helen Houghton, leader of New Conservative Party, my own page is out there. I'm going to be, might be a bit too soon, but towards the end of the year, I'm going to be releasing a book too. So I'll update you on that.
Oh, we'll stay in touch on that, Helen,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, that's
for
quite sure. Exciting. Yeah, one last thing. Kids want adults to actually be the adult, you know. I've fostered a lot of children and the ones that do the best are the ones that know that you're guiding them and, you know, you're being the adult, not expecting the children to take care, you know, take charge because they can't. Come on. Okay. Thank you for this time, Marie.
Oh,
it's been great.
It's always a pleasure to catch up with you. This has been Helen Houghton, leader of the New Conservative Party, and, of course, friend of the show here at Counterculture on Reality Check Radio. Of course, Don't Disappear, Marty, was just around the corner for Media Matters, and more music still here to come with Reality Check Radio.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.